Austin, Texas. I'm Christopher Schmidt, and on today's show, we talk with Christopher Leon from Minneapolis, Minnesota, in town for South by Southwest. Christopher is the principal interaction designer at Honeywell, and we talk a lot today about UX design. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. Make plans for CSS DevConf 2017. Join me with Chris Collier, Wes Boss, Mina Markham, Harry Roberts, Sarah Drasner, and many, many more in New Orleans. Early bird tickets are on sale right now at cssdevconf.com. UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, and inspiration handpicked by yours truly. Sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com and have the best links of the week sent to your email. Speaking of email, set it and forget it with the Non-Breaking Space Show newsletter. Whenever a new show is ready, it'll be sent to your inbox. All you have to do is sign up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. You can find show notes and links discussed today at nonbreakingspace.tv. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. As always, if you like the show, please tell others about it and to search on iTunes for Non-Breaking Space Show. Now, on with the show. So you're here for South by Southwest?
Yep.
Is that primarily why you're here? Or?
Yeah, well, I'm here for two reasons. I'm here to go to Interactive.
Okay.
And then I work for Honeywell, which, like in the U.S., is based mostly in Minneapolis.
Okay.
The headquarters worldwide is in New Jersey. But then we have a design studio here in Austin as well. We have a number of design studios around the world. And so I'm collaborating with someone here, Shudi, out of our office to do some in-home interviews, really. Although we call them OVOCs, which stands for Observational Voice of Customer. So we go in and we're trying to learn about how people live, really, and especially in respect to how they interact with their house.
Okay.
Which to many people is kind of a new idea, but more and more you can actually do it with different products. So we're trying to just learn about that. Okay. So yeah, I'm kind of here for those two reasons. Basically, whenever I travel somewhere else now, I try to work in these interviews with people I know, if I know them there. And we've got about 90 days for this particular project to learn as much as we can from people.
How many interviews would you say you get lined up or like would you have by the end of the 90 days?
By the end of the 90 days, we're hoping to have, like, in the neighborhood of 40.
Okay.
Yeah. Could be more, could be a bit less, but we're kind of aiming to do about that. And I think, I should say we're kind of on track to do about that, too.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
There's no real magic number, though.
Okay.
Basically, the person we're doing this project for, who kind of heads up this whole initiative, says, well, when you've done enough of them that you start that the patterns you're noticing start to repeat themselves,
right,
then you know you're onto something.
Yeah, diminishing returns.
Yeah, okay. But if you still feel like things are kind of chaotic and you're trying to discern patterns, then you should keep doing them for as long as you can to see if patterns emerge.
Okay. And then it'd be, I guess, terrible if you keep on doing it, you don't see a pattern emerge, and you have to, like, figure out what the problem is and come up with a new theory and
Right. I mean, you know, we do go into this with kind of a hypothesis to some extent, you know, in that we think there are going to be problems in the home we can solve. I mean, that's kind of the technology angle that Honeywell wants to approach it.
Okay.
But with this particular project, we're trying not to be too precise. I mean, it does come a bit outside of the security business.
Okay.
But we're also trying to connect things with some of the products we do in the home to figure out, you know, is there a way that we can help people with problems in their home in a new way, you know, in a way that isn't being addressed yet by the market.
Okay. Well, I'm interested in kind of like the tools that you use for your job. I guess one thing we should back up is like, what is your job title, I guess, right now?
Yeah, well, my job title actually is interaction designer. I'm a principal interaction designer.
Okay.
Which means, I guess, even though I don't feel too old yet, I'm kind of one of the more senior people in the studio. So, and as an interaction designer, as you might guess, I I do a fair amount of actual product design too. You know, so I'm designing things for screen, both for, you know, the web and web connected devices, but also just we do a lot of screen design for you know, like fixed screen, I guess you would say, devices like a thermostat or a security panel or things like that. So I come at this from the web, you know, web is my background, and mobile apps to some extent, but I came to Honeywell after a job change, and I just thought, you know, I really want to do something different. So it was both exciting and scary because I was leaving the web behind a little bit. So yeah, there's a mix of stuff I design at Honeywell, some of which is web-based and some of which isn't. But then every designer in our studio does a lot of UX research as well. So, and that's the part that I actually find that I really like, you know. Like, I like my other stuff too, but it's actually a real fun thing to go out into the field and just learn about how people do stuff. Because it makes your work that much more grounded. Like, you can go back and work on something and you feel like you're armed with good information. And that it's actually going to mean something when it's done. Which is really cool.
Because I feel like someone said, like, I forget what it was Steve or Steve Krug or Steve Portugal. I did them back-to-back interviews, so I kind of like I kind of blurred them together, which is really bad. But it's like some of those, I think it was probably Steve Portugal, but because he has a book interviewing users. But he talks about, like, you interview users to know what you don't know. Like, you find out what you don't know.
About
what you don't know.
Exactly. You know, and I've always done that to some extent, and especially when I worked on websites, I would do usability testing at the end. And I was always surprised. Like, that's when I really got into UX design, I guess, even though I didn't really know what UX design was at the time. But, like, I was always pleasantly surprised, like, wow, I would have never figured out that that thing didn't work that way without this person telling me. And I did also like the front end interviewing of clients to kind of figure out, okay, this is what they want. And I'm going to help them, like, really figure out what they want, because they might be asking for this kind of website, but they really need something a bit different after finding out what they really need to have done. So I guess I was kind of always doing this kind of work all along, but I think the bar has just been raised a lot higher where I work now.
In what way?
Well, you know, we periodically update our VP of design on different projects we're working on. And when I first started doing these updates, my slide deck was always focused on the visuals because I'm still a designer at heart, which for me is visual often. And so I'd fill up these, you know, presentations with all this visual stuff. And he'd always kind of nod and say, that's great or whatever. But he always would grill us on the testing. And say, what kind of testing did you do before the work started? Because sometimes these updates would happen like every 3 to 6 months. Like, they weren't very frequent. So he'd want to know the backstory. Like, what did we learn before we started designing? And then how much has this been tested now that it's in beta? And what's your test plan for when it's out? All the questions were about testing. And so that example, and like just a lot of the other conversations we have with him and other people around the studio, like everything is about testing and validating that we're on the right track. And that doesn't mean it can look crappy or the interactions can be bad. But his point, I think, is true, that it has to work and it has to solve a problem. And then on top of that, it still has to look awesome. And it still has to follow a design language, and it still has to have a good user experience. But if it, you know, he's worried about spending all this money on something that looks awesome that doesn't solve a problem. And I'm totally on board with that idea now, and it's totally ingrained in how I think now.
Because like otherwise you'd get like just, you know, designing for yourself rather than for the customers or for the problem, right?
And I think back to like around 2000 or even a little bit before that, when Flash was really big in the web. You know, there were all kinds of Flash-based sites that looked awesome. But I think then, especially, that was kind of before web designers really got into UX design. I mean, that was almost pre-UX design to me in some ways, even though like human factors and like the whole idea of usability really predates even the web. Like way back in the 80s, people were doing usability, user-centered design for products and things. I think that's actually when UX design started being formalized, was early 80s, I think, I've read anyway. But at least in my experience, it didn't seem to hit the web much until the early 2000s, at least in my job.
Okay.
But
so how would you define UX design?
I think it is a really holistic way at looking at how people interact with a thing or a service. So at Honeywell, for example, we look at what's called end-to-end UX. So what we're actually trying to design and influence isn't just the actual product. So whether it's so let's look at a thermostat, for example. We're still designing thermostats. You know, there's still market segments that we're designing different thermostats for. But we don't want to just design the thermostat. We want to be aware of how people learn about this technology, which is why, like earlier, we were talking about shopping and research habits. Right. Because, you know, if Honeywell has a new product but places it in the wrong channel for shopping and discovery, we've missed the boat, right?
Right.
So we want to design that experience, and especially if there's a web and an e-commerce experience, we want to help shape what that looks like.
Right.
We're even influencing how something is installed. So we help to design as best as we can connections, like electrical connections. We've designed a new way to mount thermostats on the wall to make it easier.
Okay.
We design even the user guide, you know, for how people install something, and we test this stuff, right? Like we test the user guide.
Okay.
And we test the connector, and we test packaging even.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the tail of the end-to-end experience, after you purchase something and install it, is how is it maintained and how do you enhance it? You know, is there like an upsell stream where you can add something to it or things like that? So, you know, so that's kind of the long way of saying that I think user experience design is really looking at all that stuff,
okay,
and not just having blinders on and looking at the thing that you traditionally design, which is just the thing. And then I'll add too that, like, as my role as interaction designer, I don't just look at what is so-called interactive on the screen or how you interact with a touch screen or how you interact with a website. But again, it's kind of like, you know, people interact with all those different touch points in a product. You interact with a store, you interact with a contractor who installs something.
Mm-hmm.
The contractor interacts with the package and the instructions. So both UX and interaction are seen very broadly at Honeywell.
Okay.
And I think that's becoming true. Like, Honeywell didn't invent this. I think this is pretty true in a lot of organizations, you know, that these things are like beyond just specific items and specific services. It's looking at the whole spectrum.
Okay. So like 360 design, is that?
Yeah, I mean, that might be another way to call it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what type of, because you, just so people know, like we talked an hour, I guess, for observational interview.
Yep.
For like how I use certain technologies and house and stuff like that too. So
yeah.
So that's one tool, right? It's like, what other tools or approaches would you use for UX design?
Yeah. Well, you know, on the other end of the spectrum,
mm-hmm,
is we have a lab in our building.
Mm-hmm.
So we do use kind of a traditional usability lab for certain things. So we'll take in a prototype. Sometimes it's even just a paper prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing this with some building control software last fall, for example.
Yeah.
We had a couple people fly in from other parts of Honeywell, and then two design staff, me and another guy, we planned out a protocol with questions that we wanted to ask about this prototype. And we had, I think it was 8 people come in from different organizations in the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
But people who already used this software, and we were trying to understand what this new feature essentially for the software, how it would impact them. So we do use a usability lab for a lot of things that are portable enough to test in a usability lab. Okay. And again, that was an example of testing a design before it goes into production, you know, okay, testing it early. I mean, essentially, we try to test early and often is the answer. You know, we'll do some lab testing. We'll do on-site testing.
Okay.
We'll do, you know, where we need to talk to customers, we'll meet them in their homes or in their workplaces. Because I do more commercial work, like big building stuff, we often travel to different places. And because the products that we design are national and often even international, we're like, there's a lot of travel actually, because we either have subsidiaries in different places that we're working with and do workshops with, or else we're trying to get as much of a range of user insight as we can.
Okay.
You know, we don't want a product influenced just by New Englanders. We want it to be influenced by the needs of people in a variety of different locations and climates and whatnot.
Right, so I think just to dive deeper to the UX tools thing, or the tools, but the prototyping and testing on a prototyping, how do you know what to ask? Like, say, like you have a new software interface, let's say, and like you talked about that, and like, how would you know what to ask a user? Like, and I guess you assume you get a user. A person, like, you get a database of people. I don't know if you have a database, or how would you get volunteers to come in and do that? And then also, how would you, I guess, you know, it seems like a very, maybe it's like a silly question to ask, but I feel like it's just like, that's kind of the mystery to me, is it's like, I have a problem, or I don't know I have a problem, right?
Right.
In my interface. I sketch something up, and what do I do from that point on? Like, how do I find someone to come in, and what do I ask them?
Yeah. There? Yeah. Well, I think the first part is how you find people. Mm-hmm. That can be a challenge, but I think you've got, you know, I think part of the answer is really, you know, what part of the market are you trying to address? And I use I don't use the word market as like a business person with a suit and tie. Like, I used to think market was such a business term, but really market is really just a group. It can be seen two ways. Like, market is a group of people that need something solved, and right, they have something in common is really all a market is. So whether you're designing a website or a thermostat or a loaf of bread, you know, you've got a market for any of those things. So you really have to go to your market. Now, in the case of this research project that I'm on, it's actually pretty easy because we're researching stuff in the home. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, pretty much everyone lives in a home. So finding people is remarkably easy. You know, it's like, I'm not shy about asking relatives or neighbors, or like in your case, I knew you from other stuff and I knew I was going to be here. So, you know, there, a lot of the mystery is removed there because we just network, and one person might lead you to another person, and all of a sudden you've got a dozen people to talk to.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, talking to like a building manager in a commercial building, I don't know any people like that.
Okay.
So then we rely a lot on our marketing and salespeople who are selling products routinely to those people, and or people who have contacts through a trade show or something.
Like listening to your customers?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So like with the building, with the prototype example I just mentioned, we got names. Well, actually, I think our marketing people just lined stuff up for us. Like, we just said, we needed 12 people, or 8 people or whatever. And they just said, yeah, we'll find 8 people for you.
Okay.
So sometimes it's easy enough to do on your own. Sometimes it really isn't. It kind of depends on the market you're working with, I think.
Yeah.
As far as what, you know, when you're testing something and how to know you're doing a good test.
Yeah.
I think there's a few things to observe and, and kind of keep in mind. I think one thing you really want to focus on, in fact, one thing you want to try to never focus on, ironically, is the interface itself too much. Like, you really want to focus on what we call experience outcomes. So experience outcomes are really the things that address the problem that you're trying to solve. So if you roll it all back and you go, well, you know, I've decided that for the group of homeowners we're interested in, they've all said that they've got three things that are so-called problems in their home. So let's design something that solves those problems. And so then we do whatever this thing is, some magic black box. So then as part of that, we want to address, well, how does that black box solve the problem? Like, you kind of look at it from the other direction. What is the experience of that solution? And let's say there's like four important aspects of that solution that we want to deliver as an experience. So then all we're really testing is how, you know, is that experience being delivered? So, and the reason you want to focus on it that way is you don't really want to micro focus on buttons or text or like screens or even workflows, because that gets people like focused on minutiae that may not matter as much. And it might even get you information that you don't really need. Like, they might start saying, well, I don't like the color of that or something. And it's like, you know, really, you shouldn't care about that. Look deeper. And so you can guide these discussions much better by just keeping things open-ended and ask them to basically achieve the goal that you want them to achieve.
Okay.
A great example is testing an e-commerce site. You know, an e-commerce site might have a workflow of five screens with a number of buttons and displays and whatever in it. And, you know, in my opinion, you don't want them to ask, you don't want to get too detailed about particular pages and get feedback, because that'll come out. You want them to purchase the thing and see if they can get to the end. And then as you're observing pain points, you can ask them about that and you can say, well, I see you're having a problem here. You're waiting. You're hesitating. What's making you hesitate? Then they'll tell you. They'll tell you a specific thing that you might not have learned if you asked them about, you know, tell me about the button, this button. Is it too big? Is it too small? Do you know what it does? Because then you're having them focus on that button and missing the rest of it, right? So that's a maybe too long of an answer about that. But but I think, you know, to roll it all back, no matter what kind of design you do, I think if you focus on the experience outcome more than anything, you'll still learn about all the details that you really need to learn, but you'll learn about them in a really organic way that, that allows the customer to drive that conversation.
So I can find someone, you know, who, a colleague or whatever, that you know, to find someone to do some user testing, their friend, colleague, customer. And then when I want them to test the interface out, I would just go through and say, just try to do X, Y, Z, and just talk about what you're doing. There's no right or wrong. Just let me know. And then if you see like hesitation, you just say, that's a prompt to ask for what they're thinking. Is that?
That's really it. I mean, I think that's totally it. And especially afterwards, you can have afterwards, incidentally, is a great time to talk about specifics. So then actually, if you do want to go back, like, let's say you went into this being totally concerned about three particular buttons or three particular interactions on screens, you can then go back and say, what did you think about those? Did those work well for you? And if not, can you tell me why? And that's fair, you know, but it's important to not focus on things like that going into it, you know, and that way they're more open and you're not channeling their thoughts too much. So the debrief can actually last as long as the test, we find. You know, if you spend an hour testing, you might want to spend like at least a half an hour debriefing later and going back and asking about those specifics.
And then you talked earlier, I'm not sure if it's here, but like, how many times would you do that until you get diminishing returns in your data? Or do you just do like, you know, five and call it quits?
Well, depending on what you're doing, there might be different quantities of things. Like when we're doing the observational voice of customer interviews early in a project.
Okay.
There isn't really a magic number. Like, we're not trying to be, we're not trying to do PhD type research where you need to be statistically valid or anything.
Gotcha.
You know, we tend to try to do as many as our time allows is the best answer. So there's really no magic number there. I couldn't even like propose a minimum because right. I just don't know. Like okay. like different projects and different budgets will have allow for different quantities of that. Mm-hmm. I think once you're in a project and you have a workflow of doing like a paper prototype, like a interactive wireframe where it's not fully designed yet, but it's something you might interact with like in the web world in on a tablet or on a screen.
Right.
And then you've got, you know, the product or the website more or less designed and done and developed. And then you're getting it out there, let's say in a beta form to a limited number of people. And then you get it out there to the whole wide world.
Okay.
I mean, in my opinion, again, budget and time permitting, you would test at each one of those phases.
Right.
You would want to learn how your paper prototype works mm-hmm. or even your concept. Like you could just have a concept that is kind of sketched out and more of a bubble diagram about here's what we're thinking.
Okay.
Do you like the idea? And then you can go from there to a paper prototype and test that. And then you test your wireframe again for higher fidelity. And then you might be actually trying to get feedback on particular interactions that are, you know, finer grained.
Right.
And then, you know, especially before you invest too much in development, you might test a little bit more. And I would say with each of those tests, you might do a very small group of people.
Okay.
You know, there, I've heard as a rule of thumb that around 5 people is enough because you kind of see just enough
right.
of a pattern emerging from like a small group of 5.
Yeah.
So I don't think that has to be too extensive.
Yeah, I know with the card sorting, I usually just do 5.
Yep.
And then I was like, okay, I have at least something to go on from here. Like,
yeah, yeah.
And then test it again if I need to later on.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes, like, the one example I mentioned, we tested 8 for whatever reason. I think partly it was just we had the time. You know, okay. like, we had 2 days,
mm-hmm.
and we could do 2 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. Okay. So it just added up to doing 8. So we thought, well, let's just do 8 because we've got 2 days to do it. So,
okay.
So yeah, doing a few more doesn't hurt, but as you said, you know, there's diminishing returns where,
yeah.
you know, why push it too far? Because right. You need to get back and start dealing with what you've learned rather than just keep trying to learn more.
Okay, well, that dovetails into, so you've done the research, you've either maybe recorded the observations or you're taking notes. Like, how do you get that into a report? You know, like, Steve Krug is, like, kind of famous for, like, not writing reports, you know, he just does like a phone call usually in a one pager and that's it. Cause like he doesn't want to, I think the gist is like, he doesn't want to write a report that no one reads.
Right.
And so how do you take your data that you, your observations and put it, is it a slideshow or is it? PowerPoint?
Yeah. You know, it kind of depends. And why I say that is, I think it really depends on the audience. It depends on who you're trying to educate with the learnings that you have.
Yeah.
So if you, you know, if your project is at a point where you're trying to get funding, because
mm-hmm.
this happens at Honeywell, you know, there's can be a fair amount of investment before it actually gets like the full investment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole process for that called, we call it NPI, which is new product. I always forget what the I stands for, but let's call it initiative or something. But at any rate, there's a point where there's kind of a gate that you have to go through, and to get through it, you've got to show all your design research outcomes.
Yeah.
And you're showing that to a room of execs and people who are going to be either handing the keys to you to go forward or not. And so you need that to look pretty nice.
Yeah.
That's typically slides and anything flashy you might have to bolster the text and stuff. You don't want it to be just a bunch of a big giant download of data so that they
yeah.
you know, are just crying by the end of it. But you do need to convince them. and put it together in a thoughtful way. So that's kind of the one extreme.
Yeah.
I would say internally for our teams, like just keeping engineers and other designers updated, we, you know, kind of the less is more approach makes the most sense. I mean, we want to be able to communicate what we've learned, but maybe it's just a Word document with some bullet points.
Okay.
If we have photos, though, we share the photos, and we do sometimes video record things. So all of that stuff can be useful. Again, not so much as a presentation in a formal way, but as reference.
Okay.
So if someone wants to go back and look at something, it's been put together in a way that is accessible. And as I mentioned, sometimes to like our vice president, we need to present stuff. And you know, he's the first one to say, don't over design your PowerPoint. We're not here to design PowerPoints.
Okay.
So he personally doesn't want something too flashy, but he does want something that can be explained like within an hour.
Okay.
So you get an hour of his time. You want to leave some time to discuss things at the end.
Okay.
So you don't want to go in there with 100 slides. So you're not going to get through 100 slides. You know, you might get through 20 if you're lucky. But you want them, you know, you want them to be efficient, and you want the data to be hierarchical and easy to understand, and you want to have a bit of preparation to talk through it.
Okay.
So yeah, there's a range, and like I said, I think it depends on who you're communicating the results to.
And in the preparation, what does that mean? Like in terms of preparing for a talk before a VP, like what does that usually do?
Well, I just. You know, I've done conference presentations and stuff where you do some amount of preparation, and some people even practice their conference presentations. Maybe I've missed the boat by not doing that and have made my audience suffer or something, but I at least prepare pretty well, and like I time things. I guess I rehearse enough that I speak through things and kind of time it to know how long something is.
Okay.
And so I've kind of taken those practices a bit into the office as well.
Okay.
And if I'm putting a presentation together, I'm pretty conscious, and I'll even type in the notes section what I want to say.
Okay.
I don't script it necessarily word for word, but I try to be conscious of what I want to say versus what's on the slide.
Right.
Because I hate it when I go to a meeting and people just read bullet points on PowerPoint. Like, I can do that, right?
Yeah, it's like you're driving, someone reads the billboard.
Right.
It's like, oh, man, I see the billboard too, man.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess I just kind of take the best practices that I've figured out and learned over time, kind of in the conference scene a bit, and then, you know, through previous jobs. And then, because I've had good bosses who have looked at stuff I put together, and they've told me, it's like, that's just too much stuff.
Yeah.
So take out a fourth and come back and show me.
Yeah.
Or, man, you're really verbose, you know? And it's like, yeah, I am, you know? Right. Like, I'm always told I write too long emails, and like, you know, it's just, it is what it is.
Yeah.
So I guess I try to be conscious of that when I present.
Right.
Because I don't want to have the time evaporate and only get halfway through what I want to say, right?
Right.
So, but there's a lot of people who are remarkably unprepared about stuff like that. So I think... It seems not sexy to prepare for a presentation, but it's really important. And I think for designers, it's like, it's one of the most important things we do is communicate why we're doing stuff.
Right.
And I think we forget that. I think that we think that our design is always going to do the talking for us.
Yeah.
Like, it's all about what we're making that's visual.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if that's true. I think we have to provide context and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think it was Rebecca Murphy. You know, she's a JavaScript, you know, leader in the industry, and she's, I think, more of a manager now in terms of that. And she's just a great person, and I think it was her. She talked about how when she saw speakers, even at a JavaScript conference, just be meticulous about their planning for the presentation, even to planning jokes that seem off the cuff. They would plan those like down, you know, so that when they get on stage, there's no like worry or anything like that. So it's all like, here's my presentation from start to finish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
that's cool.
And I think, and you know, when I first started out, I felt like there was people just got up on stage and start talking. It was this miracle. They could just like initialize, you know, instantly be able to like crystallize the beginning, middle, and end.
Right.
And have all these great metaphors at the ready. And so So, but you don't see, and it's one of the things I don't like about, you know, about, you know, maybe the Hollywood stuff or like the, that you see, like, you know, it takes hard work to come out, you know, to do some stuff, to do the preparation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we're missing, what I'm thinking is the 80s movies montage showing the hard work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the trick is to make it look all easy, right?
Right.
I mean, that's when you know it's successful is, you know, you just look natural and easy. But I think you're right. I think it doesn't come naturally or easily to most people, I'm sure.
Right.
To yeah. look easy.
I don't think it's very natural to, for a lot of people to stand up in front of people and try to summarize, you know, anything really.
No. Well, I remember reading, there's an awesome book. Actually, I think it was by, is it Scott Burkin? Who's this, one of the speakers who, like he was huge on the conference scene going around talking. He's got a great book on speaking, really. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember the title, but in the beginning of the book, he talks about how humans actually have a primal fear of standing up in front of groups of people.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is his theory or he read other research about this, but it's because in our past, out in the wild, any time, the only time that we were confronted by this, mm-hmm. or one of the times, was when we were confronted by predators,
yeah.
and you're surrounded by, like, let's say, a pack of animals, all right. of whom are looking at you. So we've been conditioned to think that if we have a bunch of eyes looking at us,
yeah.
that it's probably not safe,
right.
that it's dangerous. Right. And I thought, that's pretty amazing. Like right. we literally think that our audience are predators somewhere in our reptilian brains, right?
Right, yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, that's like, I think I told the last episode or maybe Steve Krug or Steve Porkle, but I think Steve Krug is like talking about how like Molly Hochschlag, one of the things she taught me was like, when you get on stage, just realize everyone wants you to win.
Yeah.
And now they're not there to kill you, you know? And,
yeah, exactly.
And they really want you to succeed. And by succeeding is by just showing that you're earnest and wanting them to learn.
Yeah.
And that's, and once they, if they see that you're earnest, you know, you've got your, like, you're most of the way there. But
yeah.
But you can't just show up and just, you know, not be prepared, you know, unless you're one of those people who can. But
yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah. So one thing I want to ask about your career is that have you always, you know, you've been a teacher and then you've, have you always been in a, I guess my, I don't want to be a negative, but like, have you never been in a agency before, like at all for web stuff or mobile?
That's correct. I've actually never been in an agency.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how, I wish I could ask you the question. It was like, my question was like going to be compare and contrast an agency to in-house, I guess is how is in-house, like, do you feel like, well, let's compare and contrast to the college, right? You taught in college. How's that?
Well, you know, teaching in college, I guess the obvious thing is that you're trying to go over fundamentals for people
mm-hmm.
who, you know, aren't familiar with stuff. So that, you know, that is pretty different than day-to-day work now where mm-hmm. I guess a lot of the design fundamentals are just kind of ingrained
okay.
in my brain. And so you kind of use them without thinking about them as much.
Okay.
Whereas you have to be really conscious about breaking down ideas and try to explain them and give good examples of them. And so like when you're teaching, the most basic things about design have become really time consuming to be able to teach it well, you know, like something really specific becomes a whole 1 to 2 hour session of a day or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, the other cool thing about teaching that I think really keeps people teaching for a long time is that students can be so brilliant and actually so good, even though they're at the early part of their careers, that it's really inspiring, I think, to be, to interact with people who just are really sharp.
Yeah.
And really get it quickly. And you know, I think any good teacher realizes that they learn from their students a lot
yeah.
because of that. And I think that part is probably pretty similar to my job now. I mean, I work in a studio that doesn't have just interaction designers, but we have industrial designers and user experience designers and researchers. So even though like I'm doing some of this UX research as an interaction designer, there's people who do that full time and who really dig deeply into preparing research protocols for the rest of us. And, you know, they help in a number of ways that I don't do all that work by myself. But, you know, so in other words, we're all working with people who are doing different stuff and inspire each other a lot.
Okay.
So I think that's pretty similar to being in a classroom, actually, because we're always learning from each other in that way. And I can't contrast my job to agency work, but I can contrast it to freelance work, which probably has some similarities to agency work. I mean, whether you're an agency or a solo freelancer, you're doing project work for clients. And so, you know, I guess one reason why in my last job change I went to Honeywell is that I guess for me, I just like the perceived safety of working for an established business. I mean, I realize that businesses change and, you know, in theory, no job is probably safer than another job. You know, Honeywell could lay people off.
Right.
Or there could be a new CEO who doesn't care about design. Okay. You know, who knows? But for me, I like kind of the stability and the established culture of a company. And I seem to fit that well. And whereas my freelance work, for a time, I did feel like I could ramp it up and work on my own. And actually, I was really interested in that for a while. But I could never get past a certain threshold where I could sustain it. So for me, it just wasn't worth it. Like I wasn't the type of person who would just go hit the streets or hit the networks deeply enough to make that happen.
Right.
So that's one thing. And I know agencies come and go. I think agencies are actually a lot more fickle than most companies. Like some agencies just disappear after a while.
Yeah.
Or they get... I don't know, like taken over by another company or I don't know. I mean, it's probably both. I think agency work is a little arguably more exciting, but it's a little more living dangerously, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, I think so.
But to wrap up that comment, I think for me, working at Honeywell is the best of both worlds because we actually have a lot of different business units doing a lot of different products that make it almost feel like an agency. And we're actually billing time to these businesses too. So in a way, the actual design practice is very much like an internal agency. We have to manage a budget. We're proposing the budget early on and proposing a work plan and all this stuff.
Okay.
So I find that to be very much like an agency, similar to when I was doing web design at a university where I was supporting a lot of different offices and research centers and I had to manage all those different projects.
Okay.
And but it was like working on a diverse range of stuff, kind of like an agency does typically. So, you know, I think people think in-house is dramatically different than agency work, but it is in some ways and it isn't in other ways. So
Yeah, I see that. I think it's also... I felt like when we did the Artifact Conference, it was, you know, there was definitely a need. The freelancers or agencies were different, and their needs were different than in-house. I felt like they needed. And it was kind of they're both the same, but I felt like, I guess I could be wrong, but I felt like the freelancers, agencies needed the tips and tricks more. And the agencies needed the how do I convince my boss? And the fundamentals, you know, and so we try to do both, but I feel like that's where the kind of the divide sort of happened.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah. So, I think that could be generally true. Mm. And I think the other way to look at in-house too is that there's still a range within even in-house design.
Yeah.
Like I described my experience at Honeywell and why I like it so much, because I do think it's very diverse and like, I know over the period of a year or a couple of years, I'll work on a wide range of stuff.
Yep.
Now, I did have a job where I was in-house at another organization, and I could only handle it for about 2 years.
Oh, really?
Because I was working on the same two things the entire time.
Yeah.
And there you have to be willing to kind of get into the weeds and really go like, okay, how is this website that's been around for 8 years?
Yeah.
Like what can it possibly do differently or better? Mm-hmm. And you do manage to find things that you can improve.
Okay.
But to me, after doing that for a couple of years, I just thought, yeah, I'm kind of tired of looking at this thing now. I mean, it's just, I don't know if I can do this for a couple more years.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but you know, to other designers' credit, I think they're comfortable with that and they like the challenge of,
yeah,
of improving something over long life cycles. And, yeah, you know, more power to them. That's great. But for me, I think I did learn that I needed a variety of stuff, and yet I didn't quite want the agency life either.
Right. Yeah, I feel like I think I would like to work on one project or like one core thing, but I would like to work on different aspects of it. You know, if that means like approaches, like,
yeah,
you know, different things. Like, oh, I can work on email marketing over here, or I can work on customer support over here or something like that. Like, and just, you know, or I can help with, you know, some other aspect of it to help the greater good, you know, in terms of like, I don't know, it's sort of like, feel like, you know, I used to grew up in Florida, and Governor, I think, I forgot his name, Graham, Governor Graham, I think it's Bob Graham. It was always, he always had the job of the day type of things. Like, he'd always, and try to relate to people, you always like have a different job every once in a while.
Okay.
And so you actually, I'm helping these people load trucks, you know, for shipping, and so that's my job for today. And,
oh yeah,
and
that's
so
cool.
Talk to people about, like, you know, that the, you know, the idea was like we talk to people and see what their pain points were, and so,
yeah,
you know, the day he was a teacher, you know,
yeah,
substitute teacher or something like that. So like, so you'd do all those sorts of things.
Huh. So, that's cool.
And so that's why I feel like that way you get like a general idea of what's going on. But yeah, otherwise you get like super bored. I have 2 years of looking at the same screen. That'd be kind of
right.
Kind of hard to take in.
Right. But, that's funny.
But yeah, cool. Yeah. I think it's good. Maybe good time. How can people find you on the internet? And look you up on the tweet machines or?
Yeah. Well, the easiest way still would be on Twitter. My handle is klayon, KLAYON.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not on Twitter as much as I used to be, but I still check in pretty regularly. I guess I still have a personal site as well, christopherlayon.com, and I spell my first name KRISTOFER.
Mm-hmm.
I don't update it as much anymore, yeah, but I still kind of hang on to it. It's one of those just-in-case things, in case I need it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a portfolio. I don't maintain my online portfolio as much as I used to, but
yeah,
but actually, as things become completed at Honeywell, so that they're in the public and I'm allowed to talk about them,
yeah,
I'll probably be updating that with some stuff,
okay,
maybe in the next few months even. So I guess those are the two main ways.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Is there any questions you want to ask me? I mean, I asked a whole bunch earlier today, but... You
know, right.
Any other questions?
I guess my only question for you is, do you still like being a designer in Austin? You must, because you're still here and you're still doing that kind of work, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure I'm a designer, but I like designing things. I just don't... I do a lot of things during the day, so... Like,
you design events?
I design events. Is that designing? Yeah, I guess so. I do... Yeah, I love bringing things together, and I guess it's called management, I guess, in some ways, but I guess it's designing is another term, but I like bringing people together around a core idea to flesh out ideas, to help people out, to learn more.
And okay.
That's where, you know, you went to Hawaii.
Yeah.
We did the Hawaii conference.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, that's the first time we did CSS Dev Conference in Honolulu. And much props to you for running through the Black Diamond and back. I thought that was pretty cool. I was like, oh man, he actually did that. That was a great surprise because CSS DevConf, that was her first year doing it. Rachel Neighbors, his first year.
Mm-hmm.
No one saw her until then. That was a wonderful surprise, and how well that came up, because we had all these people we never heard of before, like Rachel,
yeah,
speak. And that's like one of the things we loved about it, was that it's double blind voting and everyone just comes together.
Yeah.
And that was pretty fun, and we've been doing it since then. Designing, I like it. And Austin is just really great. I think it reminds me a little bit of Tallahassee a little bit, but this is kind of like a boring story, but just Tallahassee exists because no one wanted to live there. Because Tallahassee, Florida needed a capital. I think Pensacola wanted to be the capital, and then I think people in Miami wanted to be in the capital. And so they said, they kept on arguing about it. So like, hey, we'll just send out two teams, and wherever they'll meet is where the capital is. And they met to where it's Tallahassee is right now, but no one really was living there. And no one, because there's like nothing really of great natural resource there. Because here you have a river.
Yeah.
In Austin, there's a river. There's, you know, it's uneven territory, but it's like, it's a nice, you know, nice city. There's nice natural wonders and stuff like that too. So,
yeah.
In Tallahassee, you're like an hour away from the beach. You're 2 hours or so from Jacksonville, or 3 hours from Jacksonville and Pensacola. You know, you're about 5 hours from Atlanta, you know, and it's really, you know, but Tallahassee still has state capital, colleges, but it doesn't have that industry component, where Austin has the capital, has the colleges, and it has the industries. You know, there's Apple's here, AMD's here, Dell's here. And so I think that kind of helps fuel, you know, it kind of makes it recession-proof, but also, you know, just keep, there's lots of things happening throughout the world, throughout the year, with culture, you know, keep employees happy and stuff like that too. So, and of course it was quirky beforehand, you know, before the big boom.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, but now it's kind of like all the weirdness is kind of muted now with all the population growth, but and the condo growth, but that's what's happening. So
Well, and if you have another minute, the most important question of the whole interview might be this one.
Yeah.
I've read that Franklin Barbecue might be like the best barbecue in the whole universe.
Might be, yeah.
So you agree with that? Is it worth it to wait in line for like half a day?
Yeah. So it goes like, well, if you get there, yeah, you can wait half a day. Usually it's like 3 hours, usually probably right now, last time I checked. But, and I've waited a couple times. You know,
is there a way to hack the system?
Yeah, there's a way. So let me tell you the story. Like, the first story is like, yeah, you wait a half a day, and then you get the meat, and you're like, oh, you sit down, you look at it, it's like, what? Yeah, I just blew a half a day waiting for this, and then you eat it, and it melts in your mouth, and you're like, yeah, this is good. And then for the next, like, you know, the rest of your meal, you're like enjoying this, and you're like, yeah, you know, like the whole pain of waiting is just evaporated. You don't even think about it.
Yeah.
After that, so. There used to be a way to hack the system. You could actually order ahead and say, like, and the minimum order was like 5 pounds of brisket. And then you could pick it up like the next day or next week and show up at 10:30 with a cooler and just, you know, or like they give you like a hot, you know, sort of hot. But then people started hacking that pretty bad. And so now, last time I checked, is that you have to log on a certain day. They could have just code change. On like the first Tuesday every month, and then set your date and email when you want your order. And if they can't make it, they'll email you, but they'll tell you like what about it. So
wow.
And there's a whole there's the front store Franklin's, and now there's a back Franklin's whose main mission is to handle those type of orders.
Okay.
Yeah. So before you actually have to go through the front door, but now there's like a little food truck in the back where like. And I did that for Christmas or Thanksgiving last year, or some sort of Christmas seasonal break. And yeah, I had to wait like 40 minutes with all bunch of other people just waiting on our own special line for that, you know.
And wow.
So, yeah. So it is really good. And so I need to try more barbecue places, but our usual is like the McDonald's of great barbecue. Is Rudy's, which I think you've been to.
Yes.
Rudy's is great.
Yeah.
And so that, because there's lots more locations in town, around town. And then the one I go to is called Smitty's. And that's probably a 45-minute drive, half an hour drive from here.
Okay.
And it's really just great. It's just, but they close around 5 or 6 every day or something like that.
Hmm.
And, but yeah, that's as close as I've come to like, Franklin's level, but there's no way, because like Franklin's is like I think they take like they age the meat for 2 weeks, and I don't see a lot of other barbecue places aging meat that
long. Wow.
And so,
well, good to know. I don't know if I'm gonna make it to Franklin's or not, but
so
yeah, if not this trip, another one.
Yeah. And then I bet they've been slammed with all the South by parties too, trying to get all those all those VIP parties, which we're not invited to yet. So, yeah. Oh, you could be. I'm not going to speak out of turn for you. But,
no, I'm not.
So I'm pretty sure Franklin's right there for the best VIP parties at South By. So, cool. That's a good question. Hopefully I didn't bore you with my barbecue answer.
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Well, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.